This is Poetry on the Move. In this episode, two poets from two very different places. We talk to Scottish poet Pamela Besant about her life and poetry in the Orkney Islands. And we hear from Singaporean poet Tanya Di Rosario performing at last year's Poetry on the Move Festival at the University of Canberra. Tanya Di Rosario is an artist, writer, and curator from Singapore, interested in issues of gender and sexuality. Tanya is the author of Tender Delirium by Math Paper Press, and her literary memoir, And the Walls Come Tumbling Down. Tanya's poetry and fiction have been published in numerous journals and anthologies. She has also written extensively about art, with her most recent commission covering the local and Southeast Asian collections of the National Gallery of Singapore. Her practice hovers on the intersections between text and image, and her work has been showcased in London, Spain, Amsterdam, Singapore, New York, and San Francisco.
I like to start with a bit of humor because poetry-wise, emotionally, it's all downhill from here, so feel free to leave if that's not your cup of tea. I write a lot about the experience of being a queer woman in Singapore. So I'm going to have a bit of that as well as random love poem thrown in for good measure. So the first piece I'm going to read is called After Sappho. And I'll just go for it. Long before we were denied access to our lovers on their deathbeds, long before our shaved heads outraged you and long tresses confused you, long before we identified each other through stride, shirt, and prolonged eye contact, long before we were teenagers beaten, called names, run out of homes, long before we were children drawn to that one lone woman not in a dress, long before the violence of history, pulpit, language, and pen were enacted upon our bodies, long before the narcissism of your pornography and the delusions of your medicine, long before the secret spaces filled with longing and failed marriages filled with excuses, long before Ruth said to Naomi, "Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried," long before Sappho proclaimed her words immortal despite being only breath. Thank you. This is called The Sum of Our Sleep. Since splitting up, we make it a point to sleep in separate beds. Dreaming of different futures must involve this neat incision, cannot be done side by side. The curse of cohabitation, the lease on love expiring before the end of the tenancy agreement, our house now uncharted territory to be navigated. The ache for the other each night is the heart's insomnia, a new lesson in self-restraint. This unlearning of intimacy, a slower return to a lesser life. Sinking into slumber without you, my skin feels misplaced on its own body. The divided sum of our sleep leaves me in pieces. I have a mother poem, which I've decided to read because I feel like everyone has a mother poem, whether or not they've written it yet. And my mother was a bit of a character, and she kind of is a recurring motif in a lot of my work, but this is called Shrink. 9 years old. My mother is feeding me slimming pills. She wants to shrink me down to a manageable size, to fit me fetus-like into her palm, to curl me back into her tummy, which she attacks with the same oval tablets. I will not be her easy child. I will not be small, will not be pretty, will not grow into hours of preening, primping, peering into mirrors, into the way she obsesses over cameras that shrink her down to an action figure so tiny she fits the box in my living room. Television started as a job that paid, but ended as a loan shark who knew not only where she lived, but how to get into her head. Sell a vision to a woman whose only vision of herself is the youth she lost, the body she had, her face unlined by the lies of love, and she will surely buy into it. The magic exercise machines, cosmetic products, women she once looked like selling her back to herself like a bad drug. Not dissimilar to the big brown pills she urges down our throats before mealtime. I refuse to partake in sorrows that are not mine. So when I was coming out in my early teens in Singapore, there wasn't very much visual culture that you could look at as a queer person to kind of sort of model yourself on. This was partially solved by being in a all-girls convent school because half the population was dating each other. But even in that, you know, even in that space, there were still very rigid roles that people could occupy. You could either be hyper-masculine or hyper-feminine, and every time you sort of spoke about liking girls, the first question that would come up would be, what type do you like? And I've always found this question kind of obnoxious. And I think it's also because I never really had a type and I still don't. So I decided to write a poem called, What Type Do You Like? So that the next time I get this question, I can be like, buy the book. So this is called, What Type Do You Like? Deciding always gets me confused. I've never been into designer labels, butch, femme, andro, dyke, crew cuts, China dolls, jeans that fit to different degrees of gender, top and bottom, who pays for what where, who says what when, who pulls out chairs, who wears the pants. Are we so short of pants that only one of us can wear them? Strange to be framed through boxes of words when our eyes say more than we are able to hide from each other. What type do I like? I like the tradition of Times New Roman. Slender capitals of her body like pillars found in the hearts of Greece. I'm drawn to the curves of Helvetica, smiling and friendly, flesh round like the moon, disguising the edges of her voice with laughter. Courier, because she believes in Bohemia. Black letter because she's hard to discern. Throw in some wingdings for the purpose of obscure conversation. There is no type that fits the drop-down menu of things I desire. A lover who draws lipstick hearts beneath the creases of her shirt, who hikes up her skirts to get to the third step of that ladder in one go, whose presence breaks boundaries, routine, and the ice. Whose heart reveals like a mirror full length and full breadth, reflects the way light does off the water, conceals thinly that crevice cut out by rivers, that ravine of what it means to be human. Thank you. Okay, so I'll just end with this. In Singapore, there's a culture of living with your parents until you get married, for the most part. And this is completely understandable because living costs and renting are ridiculously expensive at home. But we do have a phenomena of gay people moving out much earlier, either because you're thrown out of the house or because it's just really uncomfortable staying with your parents and being yourself. So I left my family home in my early 20s without telling anyone I wasn't coming back. That kind of gives you an idea of what my family was like. And because of economic reasons, I was moving continuously for a number of years after that from house to house. So I became very obsessed with the idea of leaving things. So I decided to write a poem or a series of tutorials about how to leave. And that's what I'll end with. This is called Leaving Tutorials on How and When. Tutorial 1, parents. Do it wordlessly. Explaining yourself is pointless. No answer vast enough to fill space between strangers. Do it when the house is no longer a familiar place, but a battleground for ancestral baggage. Do it when home becomes any land far enough to fling yourself without falling off the edges of hurt and truth. The fact that anger is really disappointment in armor, that blood is only as thick as water when the temperature is just right and when we don't have it on our hands. That familial instinct is just a bunch of chemicals spilling into parts of our guilt that tell us you and I were meant unconditionally for love. When really, without these labels, anyone would think it absurd, us sharing a name or face or meal, a history that goes against all that is natural. 2, lovers. It was over when she asked me to change, not as a person, but out of the dress I was wearing. We were going to lunch. Could I please put on something nice? I knew it was over, not because I fought back, but because I obeyed. I stopped fighting once I stopped caring, and once I slipped out of that dress, I slipped out of her grasp. The next 3 months she spent picking fights, I spent unpicking us. This meant that when we finally split, the threads came apart with ease. I went back to my dress. She went back to dating people who think that the clothes on your body reflect what you embody. My taste has since improved. 3, friends. Be wary of 2 things, of forgiveness, of the past. Some wrongs were not meant for mercy, some memories not meant to map out a future. Choose survival over sentiment. This growing up hurts, this bomb in the teddy bear, this decoding of childhood. Throw everything away. Cards filled with lyrics, sleepovers filled with conspiracies, parents filled with suspicion. It will feel like the end of magic, as though any enchantment afterward might be explained away as trickery, trap doors, sleights of hand. It will feel like an earthquake hit home, taking only 1 room. But don't be deceived by a house intact. That door stands as a warning. Where once was safe space is a room filled with broken things. 4, God. Escape through the loopholes in sermons. Survive brimstone, fire, your parents' ire, your friends' unwanted prayers. Repossess desire submitted to higher power. Retract all your confessions. Your sins are yours to own. Turn parables over like pebbles. Skip them across lakes of revelation. Let them sink forgotten like verses, hymns, clockwork chimes of guilt. Do not worship anything that fails to live up to your standards of love, but always make sure that love is the standard. There will be salvation yet. Final one, home. Inside your ribs is a chest of drawers. Keep your secrets safe inside them. Your arms are a bed you can sleep in. Rest assured that you will dream. With your mouth, invite others in. With your eyes, lock them out. With the blades of your shoulders, cut them off with a shrug. Keep your spine intact, your head high. Shape a mansion out of the air that you breathe. Let your lungs expel the smoke of a heart built with the brink, a heart built with the brick of your bones. You will be loved, if only by you. You will find peace, if only alone. You will unearth a home inside yourself, and you will be enough. Thank you.
That was Tanya de Rosario reading at last year's Poetry on the Move festival. Pamela Besant, from Glasgow originally, studied English at Oxford University and now lives in Stromness in the Orkney Islands. Her poetry collections are Running with a Snow Leopard and Orkney, a Celebration of Light and Landscape. Pamela was the first George Mackay Brown Fellow and is part of the Scottish Book Trust's Live Literature Scheme. Pamela is currently director of the annual Orkney Writers Course for the St. Magnus International Festival. She's speaking here with Owen Bullock, about the role that the dramatic landscapes of the Orkney Islands plays in her poetry of place.
You've written a lot about the Orkneys, obviously, and yes. In your workshop during the Poetry on the Moon Festival, you've talked about how landscape can shape and inform poetry. Can I just ask the obvious question about how it's affected your work, what the landscape has given you?
Well, yes, I'm not native-born Orcadian. I was born in Glasgow, and my idea of landscape when I was growing up, it was, you know, the high mountains, Ben Lomond, and the west coast of Scotland. That was my idea of scenery and landscape, and cityscape, obviously. So when I ended up in Orkney by a circuitous route, I found it, I remember the first time I went, and I found it quite an alien landscape in a way, very low-lying hills, very beautiful, and this huge sky. It's quite an exposing place, but I was immediately drawn. There are so many things there that to draw you. For instance, the archaeology. You can't move for Neolithic archaeology just about wherever you walk in a field. The birds, the wildlife, and the people, a very creative community, and a very lively and dynamic community. So I was immediately aware that there was a lot going on in these very remote islands, and was very interested in the landscape, which is beautiful stone, sandstone. There's a cathedral in Kirkwall, which is the main town, which is dedicated to St. Magnus, which is made of red sandstone, well, red and white, but the overall impression is this big red sandstone cathedral. It's just beautiful. So I was very struck by this, by the stone and the and then miles of pretty much empty, fantastic beaches as well. Mm. You know, there's a wild sea around Orkney. It's where the Atlantic meets the North Sea. And it can be very wild. The Pentland Firth, which is the stretch of water between Orkney and the Scottish mainland, is pretty notorious as a dangerous stretch of water.
Right.
So it's not far, but it can be hairy. And all that is quite exciting.
Yeah.
The contrast of light and dark is very striking. In the winter, it gets dark by about 2:30, 2:45 in the afternoon.
Mm.
In the summer, it doesn't really get dark at all. So in the summer, you forget what midwinter's like, and vice versa. And I like that contrast. You know, it is exciting. And then a fairly constant wind as well.
So there's plenty of drama in the landscape.
Weather, yes.
Must get
drama,
you going.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you're settled there now. You've been there how long?
Been there for 30 years.
30 years.
Yeah. So I think we're pretty much settled, yes. Uh-huh. We never actually sat down and said we're going to stay here forever. But the children were born in Orkney, and we're still there.
Mm.
Finding you in Ratquick's a bay in the island of Hoy, which is just to the south of the Orkney Islands, and it's the highest island and very beautiful landscape there. It has a bay. The Ratquick is a bay which is more or less abandoned in terms of people living there permanently, but a lot of Stromness people have second houses there. It's the most beautiful, rarefied place, very conducive for creative people. Anyway, this is Finding You in Ratquick. In Ratquick Bay, stones are pink with the effort of smoothing so much time into perfectly flawed roundness. They lie in a colony, a petrified spawn of dinosaurs' eggs. And from this distance, the cliffs are tame, postcard pretty. A fulmar wheels from its nest, tilts the world away from the sun. A distant speck jumps through the binoculars, detaches from the steep and slatted rock, becomes a little figure running, a tiny chaos making for an open shore.
And you've also commented on the way sense of place and belonging can assist the development of your voice and things like that.
I think so.
You feel
a
sense of belonging.
Even a sense of not belonging.
Right.
You know, this has been a constant question for me. I feel now very at home in Orkney, and I feel like I've been accepted in Orkney, but at the same time, I know I don't come from Orkney. I don't feel, when I go back to Glasgow where I grew up, I feel a bit alien there. I've lived in several other places and they don't quite feel like home either. And sometimes I'm asked to read outside Orkney as an island poet, and I feel I always have to give this disclaimer at the beginning saying, well, I am an island poet now, but actually I can't claim to be an Orcadian poet. So I've been sort of thinking about this question of what gives you a sense of place and or not, you know, what makes you feel out of place, and whether that's how that informs your work, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing or a bit of both, I don't know.
And what would it be for you that most gives you the sense of place?
I think actually where we live in Stromness, which is the second biggest town in Orkney, I think it's that place. It's, I feel, you know, there, out of everywhere in Orkney, I feel is home and I feel accepted by it. And it's a unique kind of town. It hasn't changed for 400 years since it was built. It's very beautiful, very unique. And when I come back, when I've been away, and come back and see Stromness again, I think, home, I'm home. This is quite an old poem now, but it's my sort of hymn to being accepted by Stromness, where I've lived for many years now. It's called Out With My Loves on a Windy Day. We walked anti-clockwise round the shore path, defiant, straight through the steel bars of the facing wind. The hills of Hoy stood near and remote, strips of strong light fanning their dark sides. My loves and I were walking in the wind on the very rim of the world. The rubbled path tickled Alex's feet and she teetered on sturdy shoes. She laughed as her hair streamed out, kicked through a zigzag of interesting rack, wondered where the storm-blown sand had gone, felt my coat pocket for polo mints. Ian, half in and out of his thoughts, collected firewood, found something for Alex, ambled, bear-like, watchfully, this way and that, and the Ola, wind-caught, shot past Ness Point in a dogged, lurching mainland dash. I felt the familiar ferry pang, left behind, although I don't really want to go. We battled through the campsite, up the south end, past the cannon, red-limbed, out of breath, till the gale broke on hard, historical stone. We had come widdershins to Stromness, but the town was gracious, it let us pass. We finished our walk, my loves and I, came home on a windy day.
And you mentioned before there's plenty going on there artistically.
Oh yes, we have the Peer Arts Centre, which is a really cutting edge art gallery. It was started in the 70s through a donation of some of the very famous St Ives artists, Bed Nicholson and Barbara Hepworth. A donation of their work started the gallery, and it's a contemporary art centre which is, you know, holds its head up. You know, anywhere in the UK, people come from far and wide to visit it. Also, we've got we have a lot of scientists in Stromness because there's been a big push, you know, to research renewable energy, and Stromness is in a very strategic place because of the tidal situation. Mm-hmm. So we have all these scientists and marine biologists and all these very creative people all banging against each other in the town, and it's a small town, so that's pretty exciting, really.
Quite unique combination. So going back to your workshop again, what were you really hoping that participants would get out of it in terms of, you know, learning from your story a little bit and your experience, and you know, imbuing their poetry maybe with some sense of place or landscape that...
Yes, just really that, because I'm aware, you know, in a place like Australia, often people come from somewhere else, or feel that they do, or feel that they have forebears that come from somewhere else. And I know that, you know, people here are often sort of researching that past and are interested in it. And I just think it's a very useful thing to do. It can be quite difficult, and sometimes it's actually quite emotional for people. It sparks things that are you know, quite deeply personal or things that hadn't really struck them before about how they feel about their own place and their own writing. So it's slightly risky. You know, I certainly don't want to put people in that position who don't want to be, but it was, you know, what we did in the workshop, we produced two quite formal 5-line poems, mirror poems, sort of here and there, and here and there is open to interpretation by, you know, in whichever way they want. It could be an internal thing, or it could be a, you know, just a journey. And then we finish with a group poem, which is based on a Malaysian prayer, to a community prayer, to help somebody find their lost soul. And it's just, I mean, it's a formula really for everybody to contribute. It's an inclusive thing. So it's to dream of leaving, to dream of travelling through, to dream of arriving, and everybody contributes a line for each of these things. It makes a rather beautiful poem in the end. So, I mean, basically that was it. I was interested to know, you know, a bit more about the individuals who were at the workshop and what their journey had been. So that's always great, and I always think in a situation like that you're there to learn from the people there as much as you are to share, you know, what you've brought. So okay, I'll read In Orcadia, which is quite a dark poem in lots of ways, and obviously is a play in Arcadia for some people who have lived in Orkney. For some Orcadians, paradise is not the case, and particularly amongst the farming community, suicide rates have been quite high. I think it's probably the same everywhere because of the isolation maybe of that, you know, line of work, and also the easy access to weapons that farmers have. Anyway, in Orcadia, there's a luxury in watching the sea. Its liquid muscle flexes in the tide. Mass force grumbles warnings which nobody heeds. Sun on the water catches David's eye, and he looks away, annoyed, thinking about the harvest coming in and the worry of it all, and the dull pain left by the death of his mother, and the sharp pain when he sees his father with some other woman. Someone shouts his name. He squints, sees the peedy boy from up by, eyes sparkling, come to ride the tractor. Out of habitual kindness, he welcomes the boy, digs up tatties for the family whose crop had blight this year. 2 days later, his father found David, shot through the head, lying quiet in his room. Today, there's a big turnout for the funeral. The small boy frowns, puzzles intensely over the mystery. David said he could ride the tractor Sunday. He didn't say he planned to be dead by then. A new, sharp, bright stone goes up. It has the luxury of watching forever the flexing sea.
Thank you very much, Pamela.
Super. Thank you.
This has been Poetry on the Move. I'd like to thank our guests, Tanya De Rosario and Pamela Besson. This podcast is made possible by IPSI, the International Poetry Studies Institute, and the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Faculty of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra. Thanks for listening.